This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is Minisode number 3, Courtney Clay Update. In episode 49, I told you the story of 20-month-old Courtney Clay, who was sexually abused and murdered on February 25, 1997, by her mother's boyfriend, Casey Williams. After an unthinkable 9-year court process, Williams finally accepted a plea agreement in 2006, pleading guilty to murder and predatory criminal sexual assault in exchange for a 48-year prison sentence. However, due to a glitch in Illinois law that has since been corrected, Williams was only required to serve half of his sentence, and on February 25, 2021, after 24 years in prison for the rape and murder of a baby, Casey Williams walked free from the Dixon Correctional Facility. In this minisode, I'll cover the recent developments in Courtney's story, including her killer's parole, his current whereabouts, and how his release has affected Courtney's family. I'll also talk about the absolute necessity of amplifying the voices of Courtney and her family to drown out the voice of her killer. If you haven't yet listened to episode 49, I definitely recommend doing that before you listen to this minisode to get the full story. I'll include a link to the episode in the show notes. My sources for this minisode are the Chicago Times, the Justice for Courtney Clay Facebook page, Change.org, Patch, The Courier News, Wikipedia, and the Northwest Herald. On February 25, 2021, which was the 24th anniversary of Courtney Clay's death, her killer, 47-year-old Casey Williams, was released from Dixon Correctional Facility in Dixon, Illinois. Many people wonder why and how a felon convicted of the predatory sexual assault and murder of a toddler could possibly have been paroled, and that's more than fair. As I explained in episode 49, it was a very specific and very unfortunate glitch in Illinois law that allowed this to happen. When Casey was arrested and charged for Courtney's rape and murder in 1997, Illinois' truth in sentencing law required those convicted of a violent crime to serve 100% of their sentence. For sexual crimes, the requirement was 85%. Casey should have been forced to spend 48 years in prison for his crimes, less 3,375 days credit for time served, since he sat in the Kane County Jail for over 9 years as the court process dragged on, delayed over and over again by his own legal wrangling. Based on sentencing guidelines in place when he was arrested, Casey should have spent most of his adult life in state prison and been released when he was well over 70 years old. In 1999, however, the Illinois Supreme Court ruled the truth in sentencing law unconstitutional because it violated the single-subject legislation requirement under the Illinois Constitution. When the law was struck down, 18 inmates were released immediately, and the decision also reduced the time required to be served by over 2,500 other state prisoners. Unfortunately, Casey Williams was one of those 2,500, and he was actually given the decision either to serve his full sentence or to serve 50% of it. Of course, he chose the latter, and that's why he walked out of Dixon, essentially a free man last Thursday. Casey is required to register as a violent sexual offender for life, and he must wear an electronic monitoring device and attend counseling for the entirety of his 3-year mandatory supervised release period, during which he has also been ordered not to have contact with Courtney's family. None of that is the slightest bit comforting to Courtney's family, especially her mother, Greta, and sister, Christina, who was 5 years old at the time of the crime. Greta knew Casey from high school and was romantically involved with him twice. She and her daughters lived with Casey, and he was watching the girls while Greta worked the night he sexually abused and murdered Courtney, whose death was ruled a homicide caused by blunt force trauma to the head and abdomen. During a police interview the next day, Casey confessed to police that he forcibly molested Courtney. After she began crying, he told them, he covered her mouth and squeezed her head until she stopped breathing. He initially planned to stage Courtney's death as an accidental suffocation by placing her face down on a plastic bag, but he ultimately decided to take her to St. Joseph's Hospital, where medical staff noted her injuries and contacted police. Courtney was pronounced dead on arrival. After Casey's arrest the night of Courtney's death, Greta never spoke to him again. He mailed her a letter from jail in a weak attempt to apologize, but she never finished reading it and turned it over instead to the Elgin police. In the letter, Casey said he had been abused as a child and begged Greta for forgiveness, writing,
"I can't say how sorry I am. I say it every day, all day. I cry in front of 30 or more men every day, but I don't care. I wish I could die to bring her back. I truly do."
Yeah, buddy, that makes all of us. Casey also claimed to have found God during the first few weeks of his imprisonment. How convenient. The letter continued,
"Please come to the Lord and accept him as your savior, please. I'm sorry to say this, but it's the only way you will be able to see Courtney. I know she is with him right now, hoping you will."
This manipulative son of a bitch had the nerve to pull the religion card on the mother of the 20-month-old girl he raped and murdered. Let that sink in for a minute. Don't worry. You're going to get much angrier before the end of this minisode. Reportedly, Casey Williams had planned to live with his father, Michael Williams, in Carpentersville, Illinois, upon his release from prison. Michael Williams is, to put it lightly, a piece of work. He was responsible for many of the delays in Casey's court case, which, as I mentioned, dragged on for 9 freaking years after Courtney's death. Michael threatened, harassed, and intimidated Casey's court-appointed attorneys relentlessly to the point that he was eventually ordered by the judge not to contact any member of the defense team for any reason. Michael is also a convicted felon, having spent several years in prison on drug charges. He's also reportedly a master manipulator and an all-around terrible person. As Greta left the courtroom after Casey's sentencing in 2006, Michael snarled at her,
"You're going to get yours."
For what? His son was the one who confessed to raping and murdering Greta's not even 2-year-old daughter. It wasn't just Michael, either. Being a shithead seems to run in the family. Casey's brother, Scott Robarge, is also a petty criminal and multiple-time felon. One of those felonies happens to be a conviction for a 1998 incident in which he harassed and threatened Greta as well. As far as family activities go, Casey's family needs to take up birdwatching or maybe build model trains or something and leave Courtney's family the hell alone. The only reason I bring up Casey's brother Scott in the first place is because Casey was initially paroled to Scott's address on Briarwood Drive in Crystal Lake, Illinois, which many of my listeners will recognize as the city where 5-year-old A.J. Friend was murdered by his parents, both of whom are current guests of the Illinois Department of Corrections. The neighborhood surrounding the cozy little house on Briarwood Drive is very cute, packed with single-family homes with multiple parks and trails in the area. The Robarge house is less than 3 blocks from West Elementary School. An official actually went to the area and measured to ensure the distance from the house to the school was at least 500 feet before Casey was permitted to live there, because the difference of a few feet is definitely enough to discourage a child rapist, I guess? The McHenry County Sheriff's Office said in a news release that the local school district was notified of Casey Williams' release into the neighborhood. Sheriff Bill Prim said,
"I understand the residents' concerns with Williams' release into our community. I want to reassure the residents that we proactively and continually verify all of our registered sexual offenders' information to ensure that they comply with the Illinois Sexual Offender Registration Act."
Neighborhood residents were not satisfied with that and were not shy about voicing it on social media, to reporters, and on change.org, where a petition demanding Casey be moved elsewhere garnered almost 3,000 signatures. The petition stated,
"Concerned residents of Crystal Lake demand reversal of this early release and immediate removal of this cancer of society."
That's not bad. It's too bad this malignant tumor of a so-called human being can't just be cut out and tossed in the trash where he belongs. Neighbors told the Northwest Herald that they were extremely upset by the introduction of a violent child predator into their peaceful community, which is home to countless children. Well, it didn't take long for their voices to be heard, because before Casey had been out of prison a week, he was moved to 6655 South Perry Avenue in Chicago's Englewood neighborhood, which is a place so dangerous and unwelcoming that even police reportedly avoid going there unless absolutely necessary. According to Wikipedia, Englewood is known as Chicago's murder capital and is home to more homicides than any other neighborhood in the city. Casey should fit right in. In fact, the apartment building he lives in now is home to several other violent sexual offenders currently on mandatory supervised release. God, I'd hate to be a realtor in that area. I'm only stating the address where Casey is living because it's public information, thanks to the state sex offender registry, and it has been publicized in other news outlets already. According to his adult niece, Amber Robarge, her uncle and other members of the family were threatened and harassed since Casey's release from prison, and her dad's house was even egged. Jeez, it's almost like they were harboring the rapist and murderer of a toddler or something. Residents of Crystal Lake are thrilled he's gone and are now allowing their children to play outside again. For anyone living in the Englewood neighborhood in Chicago, apparently at their own peril, 47-year-old Casey Williams is about 6 feet 2 inches tall, weighs around 235 pounds, and has naturally brown hair that is now salt and pepper, with a prominent chin covered by a black and white skunk-like beard. Don't worry, I'll provide pictures of your friendly neighborhood violent sex offender in the Facebook photo album for this minisode. Courtney's father, Jesse Clay, created a Facebook page called Justice for Courtney Clay after news of Casey's impending release broke about a month ago, and he is dedicated to educating the public about Courtney's case, making people aware of her killer's whereabouts, fighting for justice, and preventing any other family from going through the same. Jesse, who now lives in Missouri, drove all the way to Dixon and stood outside the correctional center all morning in the freezing cold on Thursday, February 25th, hoping to catch the eye of his daughter's killer. He told the Chicago Tribune,
"I want him to see someone is here for her. His time may be done here, but she's not forgotten."
Unfortunately, Jesse and the media were prevented from entering the prison's property, even the parking lot, and they were not permitted to watch the human tumor leave the building. They had to try to catch a glimpse from across the street. After leaving the prison unfulfilled, Jesse made a stop at Bluff City Cemetery in Elgin to visit Courtney's grave. He told the Tribune of the day Courtney died,
"I was on my hands and knees, bawling. I think that day something snapped in me. A lot of people tell me I'm not the same. I've learned to celebrate her life instead of mourn her death. Then this happened, and it brings it all back like 24 years hasn't passed."
Courtney's mom, Greta, spoke with the Courier News last week, describing Courtney much as she did when I talked to her in episode 49.
"She was silly and stubborn, but she was always happy. She was always laughing."
Greta talked about Courtney playing mommy with her own babies.
"She got a doll and a little stroller. We'd go up and down our little hallway. She would lean down and gibber to the doll and make sure it was tucked in."
Greta also described her vivid memories of the night of Courtney's death, from her ride to the emergency room with a friend and co-worker, to the moment she was given the horrific news that Courtney was gone.
"I don't think a lot of people understand when you're in the situation. It's almost an out-of-body experience, like you have a split personality when they tell you something like that. I remember sitting there thinking, why am I not responding? How can I just be sitting here? And who is screaming? Later, my dad told me it was me screaming. He had to hold me down."
On the day of her ex-boyfriend's release from prison, Greta did not go with Jesse to Dixon, unwilling to catch a glimpse of the man who brutalized her baby.
"I don't want to take the chance of seeing him. I don't want to see him ever again. I don't want to see his face."
Greta also posted a victim impact statement she wrote after finding out that Casey was being released, and it was so powerful and eloquent, I asked her permission to read the statement on this minisode, because I feel it's so important for those of us reading about and watching this family's tragedy from the outside to put ourselves in their place and try to understand their feelings and actions. So many people are willing to place blame where it doesn't belong that it literally makes me nauseous. Some of the comments I've seen about Greta in particular, just like the comments I see about innocent parents in other stories I've covered, are despicable, and they make me despair for the future of the human race. If we're not going to practice empathy toward others, we might as well just let the robots take over. Come on, Skynet, bring it. With that, here is Greta's recent victim impact statement.
"Why? This is the question that has haunted and tormented me for the last 24 years. Why did my beautiful, chubby, red-haired, blue-eyed 20-month-old daughter die? What could she have possibly done to deserve such a violent death? Why was I not there to protect her? Why would someone I trust, someone who insisted they loved me, violate something I held so dear to my heart? Why did I not see something like this coming? Why? Why? Why was he allowed to write me a letter from jail merely weeks after he sexually assaulted and murdered her? Why was he allowed to drag this case out for 9 years? How long would this have gone on for had a plea agreement not been reached? Why were my rights as a victim violated over and over and over again? Why was he allowed to torment me through this entire process? And why the hell did no one stop it from happening? Why? Why did I, at 23 years old, have to explain to my 5-year-old daughter why she couldn't play with her baby sister anymore? Why did I have to tell her she died? When the state came in the next morning and took my 5-year-old from me, why was my daughter forced to lose her whole world in a matter of moments? Why was my family ripped apart and never allowed to properly heal? Not even now. Why? Why? Why have I had to carry the entire burden of this case? Why has the state made it so terribly difficult to get any type of information as to what is going on? Why am I being victimized again by the release of this baby killer? My baby. He killed my baby. Why? Why, after so many years, do I still put all the blame on myself? Why do I feel the need to carry every bit of this burden in such a devastating situation? Why can't I find a way to fix it, to ease the pain that has never gone away? Why can't I just have my baby back? That is all I have ever wanted. Why? Why? Why am I once again writing a victim impact statement that will likely make zero difference in what happens to this monster? Why am I, as a victim in this case, constantly reminded that he killed my child? Not just in my everyday thoughts of her and the ache that never goes away, but by the length of time it took to sentence him, his early release, and serving only half of his time. Why is it okay for me to lose myself in constant haunting thoughts of past events? This was my daughter. I will never stop thinking about her, but I am sick and tired of thinking about him and what he has done and what he could still be capable of. Why? 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 I am supposed to talk about all the ways the death of my daughter impacted me negatively. In all honesty, the list could fill a book. Where do I start? How does one explain the impact the loss of a child has on their life? Even more so, when that child was murdered by a sexual predator. In a matter of moments, this man took away from me someone I would have traded my own life for. Not only did he take her life, but he also took her first full sentence, her first day of kindergarten, her first love and first heartbreak, graduations and celebrations, her wedding and her children, my grandchildren. He took her beautiful spirit from so many people that loved her and still miss her every single day. It is not humanly possible to fully express the ways in which Courtney's murder has impacted my life. I have an extreme and constant fear for my children and their safety, my safety, and a fear of losing my sanity. I've been diagnosed with PTSD, depression, and anxiety. It took years of multiple therapists and numerous medications to help me mentally deal with the agony and pain I have lived for the last 24 years. I now take several medications multiple times a day so that I can try to lead some semblance of a normal life without taking my own. I have not had a decent night's sleep since the night Courtney was murdered. It started the night she died, just trying to wrap my head around what had occurred. Then came the nightmares of my search to find her. Nightly, as soon as my eyes would close, hearing her call for her mama and me following her cries through the dark all night long, night after night, I would always wake up, my heart pounding out of my chest, drenched in sweat, and barely able to catch my breath from the tears streaming down my face. When my mind could not take it anymore, I resorted to staying up all night, until I was so exhausted that I would pass out cold. I would have manic episodes and would paint rooms in the house, or redo the basement, or clean the floors, wallpaper, draw, clean, anything to stay awake and away from the pain I felt while I slept. My daughter has had similar issues, but with night terrors. One of the worst things you can see your child go through are these. Waking up to the horrific, pain-filled screams coming from your young daughter's room. Finding her in wide-eyed terror, standing on top of her bed, screaming at the top of her lungs with every single muscle in her little 5-year-old body strained in fear. There's no talking her down, there's just comforting her until it ends. Although after a while both of us had a break from the vivid dreams and night terrors, they have never gone away. They were only replaced with light sleep and days of pure exhaustion. Both of us, again, experiencing all the above at the thought of this man's release from prison. It will never end for us. We get to live with this for the rest of our lives. Christina and Courtney absolutely adored each other and were supposed to grow old together. They were inseparable, and sometimes I think they planned ways to frustrate me. Christina always looked out for Courtney, and Courtney looked up to Christina as if she were her everything. Christina helped teach her to crawl and walk and even how to dance. They would giggle together for hours over every little thing, and they would rarely, if ever, fight over anything. Christina took her duties as a big sister very seriously and constantly looked out for Courtney. She was lost for a long time after her sister died, as she didn't quite understand what had happened. It was only recently that I've shared the details of her sister's death with her. Sometimes she was afraid to tell me things about that night because she did not want to cause me any more pain, something a 5-year-old should never, ever have to think about. Over the years, Christina has had horrible reactions to crying babies. Someone was always hurting them, and severe anxiety. Anxiety so bad that it has sent her to the hospital and has affected her heart to the point that she has had heart surgery to help alleviate her symptoms. She should never have had to endure any of this, especially at such a young age. I've missed out on so many events because I'm fearful of crowds. I'm scared to death that I will turn around and he will be standing there, or one of his family members who have threatened me in the past will somehow find me, even after moving my family multiple times to feel safe. The internet is an amazing thing nowadays, and it is only a matter of time before I will be contacted or stalked by this murderer or his family. I absolutely 100% guarantee it. They always find ways. He has always found ways. I have an extreme and sometimes morbid need for all things Courtney. Court documents, news articles, photos, I have only a small handful, and a small collection of memories that have slowly faded over the years. I obtained the last outfit she wore out of police evidence and have kept the bottle she used that evening, with the last bit of water that touched her little pink lips still in the bottom, the same bottle she dropped as she toddled on her way to her death. I even secured copies of the very last photos of her, seconds away from the beginning of her autopsy, moments before they opened her up to examine the inside of her lifeless hemorrhaged eyes. Her beautiful blue eyes, once so full of life, no longer sparkling with excitement and joy. In the documents I've collected over the years, I have read things that a parent should never have to read. I should not have had to either. According to his statement, I know that he rubbed his penis on her mouth. I know that he cupped her mouth and I put her body between my knees. And when asked by the investigator, he admitted that he squeezed her while cupping her mouth so she could not scream. I know that he kept his hand over her mouth and kept squeezing, and when she stopped crying, she went limp. I know he watched her die. He cut off her air and squeezed until the light in her eyes disappeared and her poor little body went limp. He watched and he did nothing to stop. I also know from reading the coroner's report that she had some type of grab marks around her left ankle. I also know that the pattern of oval marks on her head and abdomen suggests the possibility of bite marks. Do you know what that does to a mother? To know that her child died in the most brutal way possible? Does anyone even understand how this has impacted me mentally, or the images that come to mind? Can you picture it? She may have died just shy of her second birthday, but she was my everything. When she died, it left a hole in my soul that nothing can or will ever fill. Not a damn thing. Nothing, including myself, has been the same since then. When he took Courtney from me, he took everything. He destroyed everything innocent about my life and the life of my daughter. He took a sister from brothers that never had the chance to meet her, an aunt from her sister's children that always ask for stories about her when they see her pictures. They were never given the chance to hear her laugh or experience her sassy ways or to see her incredible stubbornness in everything she did. They would never know the joy that was Courtney, my daughter, their sister, and aunt. I am nowhere near the same person I was the night my daughter died. I have lost friends, I've lost family, and I lost the life I was supposed to live, with my girls, happy and giggling over their next shared secret. It has cost me not only financially, but also mentally, and at times physically. There are days I cannot stand to be in my own skin, or to be touched, and there are days I don't want to and can't seem to live without her. Not only has he taken my daughter's life, but he has also played the system and is now allowed to walk freely at only 47 years of age, young enough to enjoy his life when my daughter did not and will never. He has not shown any remorse, made amends, or accepted the consequences of his actions. He has not shown one bit of sympathy for his victims or for any of the devastation he has caused. Why are we, the victims in this case, still being abused by this man? Why is he still allowed to breathe when my daughter is not? Why?
I promised you'd be furious by the end of this minisode, and here's why. Before he was forced to move to Chicago, the Northwest Herald had the audacity to interview Casey Williams and slap his big stupid face on the front page of their newspaper. I'm utterly appalled that any media outlet would give this deviant a voice. In his interview, Casey apologized, but notably, not to Courtney's family, saying,
"First and foremost, I want to apologize to the community here that I bring any discomfort being at this residence. I'm not trying to be a discomfort to this neighborhood, but I also want to get out there that I am innocent of these charges."
Yep, that's right. After a 9-year court process and 24 years behind bars, Mr. Cancer to Society himself is claiming both innocence and ignorance, saying he never appealed his conviction because he didn't know he could. Either he's as dumb as he looks or he's flat out lying. Maybe both. Who knows? Worst of all, he actually dared to tell the newspaper that Courtney's death was an accident, that he was under the influence of drugs and alcohol that night and must have crushed her while trying to perform CPR after he found her not breathing, and that his confession the next day was made under
great duress,
saying,
"There were big mistakes made in the charging process. They charged me before they had the proper information from the proper sources of that information."
You know what that last sentence sounds like to me? Word salad. It meant absolutely nothing. Bullshit excuses from a man who's had 24 years to come up with them. Luckily, the Kane County State's Attorney, Jamie Mosser, publicly called shenanigans on Casey's verbal diarrhea, saying his claims were
not even remotely
true.
The evidence showed that Courtney had major bruising to her abdomen, that there was a significant amount of bruising and injuries on her head, either of which could have caused her death, and that there was also evidence of sexual assault.
Casey upped the ante on his bullshit, telling the newspaper,
"I feel responsible because she was under my care at that time, but in my inebriation, I thought she wasn't breathing."
He said he'd tried CPR, but
"I'm not really a small guy, so the pressure I was applying, obviously it was too much. I don't know. I was drunk. I was high. In that state, in your panic, I shook her."
Did you notice how he switched from first to second person there?
"In your panic, I shook her."
That right there is a linguistic indicator of guilt or evasion. It's one of those telltale signs investigators look for right alongside a suspect speaking of a missing person in the past tense or leaking other information through their language. This accident story hasn't come up before to prosecutor Jamie Mosser's knowledge. She was in the state's attorney's office at the time of the case, but not the state's attorney herself at the time. She said this version of events doesn't match the forensic evidence.
"I think he's had 24 years to make it up. He needs to take responsibility for what he did. He took the life of a beautiful baby, and he did so in a traumatic and horrible way. The least he can do is let this family go on in peace and admit to what he did. The fact that he is now trying to claim that he was falsely accused just goes back into the fact that he is a horrible human being who took the life and sexually assaulted a 20-month-old little girl and didn't serve the time he should have served, frankly, for the death that he has caused."
Amen to that. This man, or rather this walking, steaming pile of dog excrement, needs to own up to what he did and then shut his damn mouth, and he and his family need to leave Courtney's family alone for good. The day of Casey Williams' release from prison, I was upset and on edge all day. My blood pressure was through the roof, and I couldn't stop checking social media for updates about the story. If that was my reaction, just imagine how Greta, Jesse, and Courtney's sister Christina felt that day and continue to feel right now. I'm pleading for anyone listening not to place blame on anyone besides Casey Michael Williams for the death of this precious, red-haired, blue-eyed baby who was deeply loved and cherished by her family. Regardless of any decisions she made at the time that might have affected the outcome of the story, Courtney's mother is not to blame for her daughter's death just because she let her boyfriend at the time, who she'd known since high school, babysit her two girls. She was trying to provide for her children and left them with someone she trusted while she worked. As they say, hindsight is 20/20, and don't tell me you didn't make any questionable choices when you were in your early 20s. God knows I did. Everyone does. The difference is, most of those decisions don't end in the death of a child, but that does not make it Greta's fault. Greta had no idea Casey was capable of such a horrific, violent, despicable act. And if she did, she never would have allowed him to care for or even live with her children, period. The victim blaming I'm seeing online, in this case and in too many others, needs to stop. Greta has lived for 24 years with her own shame and regret and guilt, even though she did nothing wrong. She is a human being just like you and me and the rest of us, and she deserves compassion, not vilification from judgmental jackwads on the internet. My heart is with Greta and Jesse and Christina and Jim and everyone else who loved Courtney. I pledge to them that I will do my part never to let this little girl's name or face or story be forgotten, and I will also do everything I can to help amplify Courtney's voice. That's it for this minisode. Join me next Wednesday for another full episode. If you like the show, please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. And please subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. You can also subscribe on YouTube by searching Suffer the Little Children Podcast. Visit the website at www.sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes and become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter at STLCPod. View photos related to today's case on Facebook and Instagram. Read more about today's case and many others at SufferTheLittleChildrenBlog.com. This podcast was written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. Intro theme music is by Dream Note Music. Other music and sound effects for the show were created using sounds from AudioJungle.net. Hug your babies a bit closer tonight. Until next week, bye guys.